사신 백의 존심의 도탄 이란 링신 년대 견반디 상계 신도 맥대 을와기 도근 남당 신라 저바소 이담 구로란 나면 따라간 여다야미 상계 최단석이 전남라 장존바도 단일 겸수치 다기 제년 기베스 남기 돌라 벤젠 상견 두바쇼 상견 제단 저기 저남라 자주 바두 다니 겹수치 다기 제년 기베스 남기 조라 벤치를 상견두바소 상계 최단 속이 전남라 자주 바두 단일 겹수치 나기 천년 기베스 남기 조라 벤치를 상계도 바쇼
Talking about Daksen Nyamba, which means to learn to treat other people and yourself the same. And it means to learn to feel about others' pain the way you feel about your own pain, and to feel about others' happiness the way you feel about your own happiness. And to work for each one of them as much as you work for those of yourself. And I think Jim asked the best question, wherever he is. Which is the one that naturally comes to your mind. You know, I cannot feel their pain directly. You know, I don't get hurt when someone sticks a pin in, or if Winston doesn't get any sleep, it doesn't make me tired, you know. And, if some other person gets some great pleasure, then it doesn't make me happy. You know what I mean? It doesn't affect me directly. And Master Shantideva, I think, gave the... I have never really heard that argument before, that with practice, other people's pain, even though you can't feel it directly, can become intolerable to you. You know, you can decide that someone else's pain is something that you will no longer accept. In the same way that you no longer accept your own, even though you can't feel it, by practice, and just by practice, because so much of what you are depends upon what you decide you are, and the boundaries of what you decide is me is something arbitrary. Those boundaries are arbitrary. You can put those boundaries where you want. You were born with a certain boundaries, and your culture has reinforced certain boundaries even by giving you a different name from other people. But those are not fixed in stone. And again, Master Shantideva will say again tonight, those boundaries are arbitrary. Those boundaries are not fixed. You can act with those boundaries as you please. And I don't know if anybody tried it. I tried it in a very wimpy way, to imagine that somebody else was myself, and then imagines trying to create some happiness in their mind as if it were my own mind. You know, and it was pretty cool. I don't know how many people tried it, but it's kind of very liberating to expand what you call yourself to another person and then purposely try to create some happiness in their mind and then sit back and enjoy watching that happiness grow and watching them enjoy that happiness. And it was very interesting, you know. It was really kind of liberating for me. I don't know how many people tried it, but we'll see. Tonight, we'll continue with that practice, and then we'll move on to another practice for getting bodhicitta. Why are we talking about these practices in the first place? We're in the chapter on meditation. These practices have nothing to do with meditation, right? No, it's what do you meditate on? And when you teach somebody meditation, oftentimes you'll see, if you ever go to a class on meditation, there'll be a great emphasis on how to sit, you know, how to hold your head, how to breathe, how to close your mind, you know, how to get your mind on certain objects. But then they don't teach you what to meditate on. You know, I have lots of people come to me and say, you know, I learned how to meditate, I know how to sit, I know I'm supposed to focus my mind, everything's clear. Now what do I do? You know, and so Master Shantideva is saying, you know, go to the forest, seek isolation, take your gentle walks, and then enjoy thinking about doing good for other people. And that's where he started with all this. That's where we are, okay? Tonight we could not finish the reading. We tried, couldn't do it. But the verses are ready. So Hector's going to do the verses. Just do one, stop at a space, okay?
Being beyond oneself. Suppose you say that the reason why you don't protect them is that their pain doesn't hurt you. Why then do you protect yourself from future pain, since it doesn't do hurt to you either?
We had this argument before, and actually it's Jim's famous question, which is going to become Jim's famous question, okay? And it is the big question. And Master Shantideva says, suppose you say that the reason why you don't help other people, why you don't protect other people, is that their pain doesn't do anything to you, it doesn't hurt you. And someone again came up with this argument, okay? So on your homework, don't forget to give argument number two. This is Master Shantideva's second argument about why you should think of others' pain as if it were your own, okay? And Master Shantideva replies with a telgir, a prasangika. He says, which is like a logical method of asking someone. You reply with a question, with a sarcastic question. And then hopefully the other guy gets it. Sometimes they don't. Okay. He says, then why do you protect yourself from future pains since they don't do any hurt to you either? Meaning, he gives three examples. He says, for example, in the morning, if you know your boss is going to yell at you in the afternoon, you might call in sick. Okay? In that case, you're helping someone else even though you can't feel their pain. Okay? So why don't you help other people as well? You're acting crazy. Okay, I'll run it by you again. These arguments seem silly or something, or they seem naive. And when you get to an argument that seems naive in Buddhism, you better stop and look at it, because it's usually extremely profound and it went over your head. Okay? He says, you don't take care of other people. Why? Because I can't feel their pain directly. Well then, why do you worry about yourself in the afternoon in the morning? You know, why do you call in sick? Because you know the boss is going to scream at you in the afternoon. Because you can't feel his pain right now, right? So that's another person. So why do you do that? Then he gives another example. He says 401k programs, okay? I guess they had them in ancient India. He says, why do you go through putting away a 401k? You know, why are you saving money to take care of this guy who's going to exist 20, 30, 40 years from now? What's the point? He's a different person. You can't feel his old age. You can't feel his poverty. You can't feel his Social Security check, $180 for a month. You know, why are you taking care of him? According to you, you shouldn't take care of him. Okay? Stop taking care of him. You know, tell your boss to cancel the 401k. Because that's another person whose pain you can't feel. Okay, third argument. Why do you take care of your future life? Okay? Like, definitely your future life is a totally different being, okay? This guy is born, not even born yet. God knows where he's going to be born. Planet Xerxes, you know, among the race of the golden bird people, you know. And you don't have any relationship with him. You're not going to be, you have no way to be aware of what's going to be happening to him. And why are you doing good deeds? You know, why are you trying to collect good karma? You're trying to take care of somebody that could be born millions of years away, millions of light years away, you know, and you're trying to take care of this guy that isn't born yet and is totally different from the person who's going to die in this life. You know, someone's going to sit in a hospital bed in New York City or in a nursing home somewhere in America and die. And then there's going to be this other guy who's born somewhere, God knows where, you know. So why are you trying to take care of him? You can't feel his pain. You know, so you're acting crazy. That's his argument. She said, isn't it the same mental continuum? He said, isn't the same mental continuum? I say, Hector, read the next verse.
Your idea that you do so because you think to yourself that you will have to experience it is all wrong, because the person who has already died is one person, and the one who has taken birth is another altogether.
He didn't answer yet, okay? He's still rubbing it in. In fact, one more verse he's going to rub it in. And here he says, this is where he brings up the idea. You say, but I have to experience it, you know. It's me who has to feel that pain of that future life. You know, therefore I should take care of him, because it's me, and other people are not me. I will come to feel that pain, myself, directly. So therefore I should take care of him. And then he says, no. You are just basing it on someone being separate from you. You know, you were emphasizing that they were separate from you, a separate person. And Master Shantideva, although not logically yet, okay, is saying, look, who could be more separate than this guy who's going to be born in some other realm? How could anyone be more separate than you? These people are sitting around you. These people are sitting on the same pew with you. You know, they're like a few feet away from you. And you're not taking care of them. But you're taking care of this guy who's totally separate. He's years and years away. He's miles and miles away, and you're taking care of him. Why? You know, it doesn't make sense. So don't give me this stuff about I have to experience it, because he's so far away and he's so different from you that why are you worrying about it right now? Still doesn't address your question. He'll get there, but not in the next verse. So do the next verse. Okay.
And suppose that any particular pain were only something a particular one had to care about. If this were the case, then a pain in the foot would be nothing for the hand. Why then does it care?
He's not addressing your question yet, okay? He's still attacking the idea that we should compartmentalize who we take care of. You know, I should put a line around Michael Roach and say, this is me, and I'm taking care of only the local person. You know, I'm going to be, what's that word? There's a French word. Parochial? Okay? I'm going to take care of the person who's in this little border, and I'm not going to take care of people who are in other little borders. So there's this border, there's this line that separates me from other people. And I'm going to take care of everybody who's inside that line, and I'm not going to take care of people who are outside of that line. So he says, in that case, then, if you're walking along the street and you get a splinter in your foot, don't reach down and pull it out, because you have to be local. You know, the hand is over here, the foot is over there. You know, hand should take care of hand, foot should worry about foot, let foot worry about the foot. Foot should take his own thorn out of his foot. That's foot's problem. Okay, why don't you go further? You know, you have a boundary. Why don't you bring the boundary in further? You know, divide all the parts of your body up. Say hand will take care of hand, and foot will take care of foot. So if foot gets a splinter of glass in it or something, hand should ignore it. According to you, if you're being logical, then go ahead, define yourself even shorter. Draw the boundary here around the hand, and hand will take care of hand, and foot will take care of foot, because it's all arbitrary. So according to you, if it's just arbitrary, we can decide what we want. Okay, hand will take care of hand. And hand doesn't have to help foot anymore, okay? If foot is itching and needs a scratch, hand will just ignore foot, okay? Because foot is separate from hand. He's saying, according to you, your logic is sick. Everyone's sitting here going, okay? He's saying the self is arbitrary. What you decide is you is arbitrary. You know, he's been begging you to make yourself fatter, you know, and try to spread out among more people. And now he's getting, like, frustrated because this guy keeps fighting him. So he says, okay, have it your way. Make yourself smaller. You know, decide that yourself is your hand, or decide that yourself is your foot. And when your foot itches, don't let the hand help him, because they're separate. You know, the hand doesn't feel what the foot feels, right? So why should the hand help the foot? You know, if it's on the basis of what they feel, the foot's the only one that's tickling. The hand's not tickling. Why should hand help out foot? They're separate. Hand's not feeling directly the thing that the foot's feeling directly. According to you, if it makes sense, hand should ignore the foot. Hand should not scratch the foot, okay? Shouldn't do it. Doesn't make sense according to you. Think about it. Rinpoche would say, cook it, all right? It's a great argument. It doesn't seem to bowl anybody over. Okay, we'll go to 20. Go ahead.
Are we only what we control? The things we call a stream or else a collection are unreal. They're like a string of things or an army. That of one with suffering doesn't exist at all, so who is he that could ever stop it? Since the one who owns a pain does not exist, there can be no distinctions among them any.
Here is where he answers that question, okay? And this is, he goes into an interesting argument, and it's a little bit difficult. It's a little bit of a preview of the ninth chapter, which has, you know, given people headaches for about 1,300 years, okay? It's difficult, all right, but it makes sense. We're going to talk about two concepts here. One is sopa. Sopa means a collection of parts, okay? When you have, for example, a holiday, you call it a tog, because it's many monks getting together, and that's a tog. So sopa means a collection of parts. Your body is a sopa, made up of your hand, your feet, your arms, your legs, your torso. That's a tzokpa, okay? That's a collection of parts. And it takes a tzokpa to make a thing, all right? When you perceive any particular object, like this pen, you're seeing the top, and you're seeing the tip, and you're seeing the bottom. And this pen is a tzokpa. It's a collection of three different parts, the top, the middle, and the tip. And that's three parts that make up a tsokpa. Master Shantideva says, look, tsokpas are dzumba. Dzumba means unreal, okay? Unreal, artificial. Dzumba means fake sometimes, okay? What does that mean? You have to think carefully about it. The pen is a fake because it's a tsokpa, all right? The pen is unreal because it's a tsokpa. The pen is unreal because it's a collection of parts. Okay? What does that mean? Why does Master Shantideva say that? And what's that got to do with what we're talking about? Remember the objection, which is it's a good objection. And it's clear that this should be an objection. I don't worry about other people's pain because I can't feel it directly. And then Master Shantideva says, well, then the hand shouldn't worry about the pain of the foot. And you can say, wait a minute, that's not true because we're all one sopa. Okay, my mind covers my hand and my foot. So I'm aware of what's going on with the hand, and I'm aware of what's going on with the foot. We're one sopa. I don't feel directly Tessie's hand. You know, if Tessie's hand has a problem, it doesn't feel bad to me in the way that it feels bad to me if one of the parts in my tsokpa, if one of the parts in the collection of what I call Michael Roach, gets hurt. It's not the same. So your argument, Master Shantideva, is stupid. Okay, we're all one tsokpa. I'm a tsokpa. My hand and my foot are connected to the same body. They're parts of the same collection. So therefore, I should take care of my hand, and I should take care of my foot, and my hand should take care of my foot when my foot is hurting, or when my foot needs a good scratch. My hand should do that, because I'm all one tsokpa. Okay? And Master Shantideva says, that's a lie. Dzum. Okay? Dzumba means lie. That's unreal. It's a tsokpa. Why? He says, because it's just like a mak. Say mak. Mak. Mak's a bad word. Mak means army. Okay? Army. Like infantry army. Mak. Okay? Mak means army. He says it's the same as a mak. Why does he compare it to a mak? Mak means you've got all these different kinds of soldiers. You've got infantry, you've got elephanteers, you know it. You've got archers. And they're all in one place. And that collection of people is called a mat. Okay? By whom? This is the difficult question. Okay? When you look at a big group of people and say, this is an army, this is the American army, G.I. Joe, you know, this whole group is the American Army. When you look at them and decide that this is the army, who decides that? Yeah, he says, you choose in a way you choose. There's actually two things going on. I mean, you choose, but actually you're caused to choose mostly by your past karma, okay? Something in your mind suggests to you, hey, let's look at that whole group. Let's call them the army. And you say, okay, let's call them the army. And the big question is, this is the big question, okay? From their own side, are they army? You know, anyone who ever came here from any planet or from any realm, you know, any termite that walked up to this group of people, would they say to themselves, oh, American army, you know? Seriously. Because if they are not army from their own side, then a termite... I'm sorry, if they were army from their own side, then even a termite should see it. And even a child, a two-year-old child, should see it. Because it's the nature of that group of people. It's their nature. It's not coming from anyone else. It's their nature to be the army. Okay? So anyone who walked up to that, a two-year-old kid, a dog, a termite, a Martian, okay, when they walked up to this group of people, should say, huh, American army. Why? Because there's something coming from them that says American Army. Okay, but that's not the case. It's not that they are not suggesting to you American Army. It's you who's organizing them in your mind and saying American Army, the same way that you are organizing the pen. We talked about it on Friday night. It's you who's deciding this is pen. This is not pen from its own side. It does not have any nature. No nature at all. No nature. It's not anything by itself. Nothing. Okay? You decide. You decide it's a pen. There's nothing here. There's just some colors here. You decide what it is. Okay? Oh, but it seems to be there. I'm really sure it's there. Like you hold it and you write with it. Why? You're organizing that in your mind. There's just some colors here. There's no pen here. You're making that. It's artificial. It's zun. It's a fake. Okay? It is not pen from its own side. Why? Because an Eskimo who comes in here and never saw a pen doesn't know what it is. If it was pen from its own side, everyone should know what it is. It's not pen from its own side. It's pen because you use it as a pen and you think of it as a pen from your side. There's no pen here. Okay? And there's no army there. Or else a two-year-old would see army and say, American army, you know? And a bug would think, American army. Okay, you gotta get it. It's very difficult. Tsopas are fake. Master Shantideva is saying, the idea of Michael Roach being the collection of two hands, two feet, two legs, two arms, is a fake. You're making that up. Okay? It doesn't exist from its side. There's no reason why you can't take care of Marty's hand the way you take care of your hand. You just decided not to. Why? Your past karma is forcing you, mostly. But now that you've grown up and you've heard this class, now you can make your own decision. You can define yourself any way you want. He perceives pen at that point. Okay? Jim said, what if the Eskimo comes and he's just fooling around, and then by accident he pulls the top off and he's just, you know, trying to eat it or something, and then he notices he's got these black lines and he's, oh, hey, look at that. And then he realizes how he can use it as a pen. His karma just changed. Because some other Eskimo will come in and not ever figure out what it's for. Very interesting. Okay? This is not anything from its own side. You are making it what it is. Okay, so don't give me this bullshit, says Shantideva, about I'm only going to take care of my body, because your body is a lie. You know, saying that I am restricted to my two hands and my two feet and my two legs is a lie. You know, you can say that there's a certain function to it. You can say that I've always thought that way. You know, you can say that my mom gave me a name and the name didn't spread to Tessie's hand. You can say that. But that's all artificial. That's arbitrary. You decide. You decide that. There is no me that exists there by itself. You decide where me stops. And you decide where me ends. Okay? It's very interesting. It's all a big fake. Me is a fake. Alright? Me is whatever. False means, zun means, you decide where me ends. Okay? So, how do we decide? What's more functional? Okay, what's more intelligent? Do I decide that after this class and say, oh, gee, I'm at liberty now to define Michael Roach differently. I can be whatever I want. Well, I decide I'll take care of my hand and not my foot. Is that functional? Does it make you happy? Will it make me happy? Will it make me happier if I decide Michael Roach is my hand and not my foot, especially if I stub my toe? Master Shantideva, as you'll see later, he'd say, the answer to your question. She says, yeah, but when you talk about expanding me or shrinking me, you're already assuming a me, aren't you? You know? And she's right. And she says, that gives her a problem, you know. I always stick on that. That you start talking about where should we define me, but you're always starting off from a me that you've already defined. So aren't you really agreeing that the me is that? No, I'm just saying, and Master Shantideva will say, I'm starting for your convenience from the me that you are used to. Okay, now, starting from that me, forget that me. Does it make sense for Michael Roach to take care of the hand only and not the foot? Shall I instruct this hand from now on, if the foot gets an itch, just ignore him? Is that functional? Will that make everybody happy? No. I'll go around with itchy feet. It's bad. Try to meditate with itchy feet, you know? It won't work. Okay, is it more functional to say, okay, Michael Roach ends at the skin and at my close possessions and at my closest friends, perhaps, you know? Michael Roach ends there. Is that functional? No. Why? The proof is you. Okay? Does it work? No. What's the proof? You. Okay? You're suffering. You don't work. It's not functional. It's dysfunctional. The idea of you is dysfunctional. You just, the way you're defining yourself now doesn't work. If you don't think so, keep getting old and die, you know? It's dysfunctional. It doesn't work. Why? It doesn't make you happy. The purpose of life is to get happy. The purpose of life is to get the things you want. Deciding that me is going to be what my mom said I was and what the world says I am, that I stop here and I don't have to worry about his body, is dysfunctional. It doesn't make you happy. And it will never make you happy. You must expand the I out. You know, me has to be everybody. And there's no reason why not, because it's Zun. Okay? You decide. And the proof is what? An army. Why? The army is not an army from its own side. It's up to who's perceiving it. Okay? You decide who's the army. How does he know? He says, that new boundary seems to have a lot of problems too. I mean, I got to take care of a lot more people than before. And you're like claiming that it would be more... You're like claiming that it would make me happy to do that. Can you prove it? We'll try. We'll go through that. That's a tsopa. How about a gyu? We just got finished talking about tsopa. Tsopa is static. Tsopa means a collection in the present time, meaning my hand, my feet, my torso. These are all present tense parts of me. And we just showed that it doesn't, that the definition of me in that way is arbitrary. You can decide any definition you want. Okay. Now how about a gyu? Okay? How about a gyu? Gyu means a stream through time. Okay? For example, Michael Roach, from the time that Michael Roach was born up to the time that Michael Roach dies, is a gyu, a stream. I stream on through time. Okay? And that, in another sense, is my parts. You know, there's Michael Roach at 20, Michael Roach at 25, Michael Roach at 30, Michael Roach at 35. And each one of those is a member of this long stream that we call the life of Michael Roach. Michael Roach over a lifetime. And that's called a gyu. That's another way of looking at me, isn't it? You know, does it make sense for my hand as part of my tsopa to take care of my foot? Yes. Does it make sense for Michael Roach at 20 to start worrying about Michael Roach at 40 and going to college so that Michael Roach at 40 can have a nice job? You know, I mean, should we take care of other parts of our gyu, of our stream, in the same way that one part of our collection takes care of another part of our collection? So in time, over a period of time, should I take care of the parts of me that are in the future? Because as Jim noted, it is my mental stream. I will have to suffer that pain. If I don't get a degree at 20, he will have to have a lousy job. And I'll be feeling that. It'll be me who's feeling it. So I should take care of the other, I should take care of the other parts of my stream, right? Gyu. And Master Shantideva says, Dzun. It's a fake. Tewa? Tewa means a string of anything, okay? It's the Tibetan word for a rosary. It's called a tewa. A garland around your neck is called a tewa, metogi tewa. And even the string of all your lifetimes is called a kirabgi teng, tse teng. It's the string of all your future lives. So it means a string of anything, okay? That's the meaning of tewa. He says, look at a rosary, or look at a, you know, in India they have these, what do you call them, leis, like Hawaiian things with flowers, flower garland, okay, like a garland. It says, look at a garland, you know, that will give you an idea of the concept of a stream. Your life and the separate ages of your life, Michael Roach at 15, Michael Roach at 20, Michael Roach at 25, string them all together, and you can call them what? Michael Roach. Okay? We can call that Michael Roach. It's not unreasonable to say that. By the way, some of that string is always gone. Some of that string is always yet to come. But in a general way, we can say, that's all Michael Roach. You know, in a very general way. Remember we had this debate. It was when we did the Future Lives, I think. There was this huge debate about, but part of that string is already gone. And another part of that string is yet to come. And really, at any given time, you only have one bead on the string, which is the present moment, which is Michael Roach at the present moment. But then the answer is, oh, but in general, you know, if you just back off a little bit, you can say Michael Roach over the length of his life, you know, that guy that they write the obituary about, you know, that's a string of different Michael Roaches at different ages. That whole string we can call Michael Roach. Who decides? Who decides? When they write the obituary, why do they only include his graduation date, you know, his illness date, his burial date, his memorial service date, you know? Why? Who decides that? The New York Times. Okay. Does it exist independently from its own side? Does it have to be like that? Not at all. It's Zoom. It's fake. We decide. We define it that way. We say these events will be this person and other events will be other people. Why? Because we decide. That's another example of false, unreal, artificial. Okay? The boundary of yourself physically in the present moment is artificial. The boundary of yourself over the length of your life, you know, looking at your whole life as a string of moments from birth to death, is also artificial. You decide. You decide which ones to include. I would like to exclude certain ones, like last week. Okay? You know? Like if I had my choice, I would just include the ones I wanted, you know? And that's arbitrary. So Master Shantideva says, don't give me this stuff about I have to take care of my 401k because that's me in the future. You decide that. Why is your 401k in 1999 more important than that person's hunger right now? You only decide that. That's your decision. You know? Oh, I can't feel his hunger. Yeah, but you can't feel your lack of a 401k 20 years from now either. Right? It doesn't make sense. It's just a bad habit to be selfish. Okay? It's just a bad habit. There's no logical reason for it. It's just you decide it that way, and your culture pushes it on you. There's no reason for that. There's no reason not to take care of other people as much as you take care of yourself. Because it's you who decides that I will call that string of lifetime Michael Roach. Because you cannot feel future Michael Roach right now any more than you can feel someone else's pain right now. She said, yeah, but I still get stuck on this thing of function. You know what I mean? Really, there's this concept of function, which means I can take care of my future 401k. You know, if I do collect a 401k now, I will have money in the future. And I will be taking care of myself. That's functional. I say, bullshit. It's not functional. It doesn't work. It's just a way to suffer and die. You have a choice. You know, you can work on that function. You can have your 401k. And then you'll die and get old. This method, this decision, I'm going to define myself as everybody in this room, leads you to total enlightenment and ultimate happiness. And that other thing leads you to death. and you're suffering, and it doesn't work. Didn't you notice yet? You know, it doesn't work. It really doesn't work. And I'm a victim of it too, you know. I spend my whole, you know, I had a certain amount of mental affliction last week. No function, you know. It is dysfunctional, and it just hurts. And all it leads to in the end is a 401k that this old, ugly, dying person uses. And so what? You know, what's so functional about that? You know, this other way of defining yourself will bring you to deathlessness. And you will not have to get old. And you will not have to suffer. That other way of defining yourself don't work. Wake up. You know, it doesn't work. Yeah. A normal person, right? Someone who hasn't come to a Master Shantideva class can be walking down the street and somebody else falls in front of them, skins their knee, and then suddenly you feel this empathy. You know, suddenly you feel like, I should take care of this person. They seem to be in pain. Where does that come from? Just karma. I mean, it's karma that limited you to yourself. I mean, you see certain people who can't think 3 minutes ahead. You see people who can't even... There are people who get A's, you know, for a few moments' pleasure... Knowingly that there's this risk, they are selling their future self, right? They're saying, I don't care about my future self. I don't care what he or she feels. I just want to be happy. I want to have some pleasure right now. And they ignore the needs of that future self. I'd say that they have shrunk the self boundary back from even 5 years back to about 5 minutes, right? And what you're saying is that due to some past karmic seed in your mind, for a moment, any normal person, many normal people without training are able to, the envelope suddenly stretches to help this person who hurt their knee. You know, I did it in Arizona. I remember a lady fell on the ice and broke her ankle and we were trying to help her and then it went away in about 10 minutes, you know. When it got to, who's going to take her to the hospital and spend 3 hours in the emergency ward with her, it's like, well, maybe you guys could go, you know. You know, the envelope suddenly came back. You know, the envelope embraced her, and then when it got to be a little bit of a trouble, everyone's envelope kind of shrank again, you know? And that's the way we are. Anyway, the other one is not functional. The way of doing it now, the way you define yourself now, which is arbitrary, doesn't work. So forget it. Try something else. Yeah. Can they coexist? You know, can a definition of yourself, which is sort of limited to what it used to be, and a definition of yourself, which is more wide, could they, in a sense, coexist? And that's true, yeah. I mean, for example, you're still responsible for your own Buddhahood. And in fact, ultimately, these things meet very nicely. You know, ultimately, it's sort of ironic that the best thing you can do for others, and I repeat what I've said before, is to reach a Buddha paradise for yourself. And that's very convenient. I mean, it's sort of like, by eating your cake, you can have your cake. Okay? And that's very convenient. You know, to tell you the truth, that's the way it is. And the more you practice, the more pleasant your life will become. You know, it's very ironic that you are resisting happiness. You know, by not wanting to practice, you are resisting very, very great pleasure, I can tell you. You know, the better your practice gets, the more pleasure you have. Even normal pleasures. The more you practice good karma, the more you make your mind sweet, the more you take care of others, it's just simply the best way to get whatever you wanted also. His Holiness calls it enlightened self-interest. So they can coexist. You can conceive of yourself a certain way, act in a larger way, get to your own Buddha paradise, and thereby be best able to serve other people. But you can't get there unless you expand yourself. You'll never get there unless you expand yourself. If you can have it any way you want, why not have perfect, absolute ecstasy? Instead of this crappy little life that we're going to now. You know? I mean, what's the choice? You know? Okay. It's true. It's true, right? Life sucks, as they say. Okay. Okay, go ahead. We'll do one. By the way, that's his argument, just to get it straight. Like an army in a static sense, like a rosary in a string sense, in a stream sense. It's all arbitrary. What you decide is you. One of them works, one of them doesn't. One of them causes pain, one of them causes enlightenment. Choose. You can choose, yeah. I think there's this, who's this psychologist? He wrote a pyramid. What was that guy? Maslow, right? Yeah. That was his thing, you know. I think there's a certain spiritual maturity you go through. You know, first you're only worried about the next 5 minutes of yourself. And then you're only worried about the next 5 years of yourself. And then you're only worried about the next 50 years of yourself. And then you start to worry about one other person. And then somewhere at the peak there, you're worried about everybody. Yeah, you have a certain, according to your own spiritual maturity at any given moment, you may be expanded beyond what other people have been expanded. Is it only sensory? I wouldn't say so. I'd say there's an emotional envelope that's bigger. There's a social envelope. You know, people go and die for a thing called a country, which is arbitrary. Totally arbitrary. Somebody goes to New Mexico and goes like 10 degrees latitude, 4 degrees longitude, and draws a line and says, people over there are not us. People over here are us. You know, totally arbitrary. People die for that. People die for that tsokpa, which is dzun. You know, yeah, in a social sense, people will die for this idea of a totally arbitrary idea that we're different from them because of a river that has to be flowing here, you know, or something like that. Yeah, so I'd say social boundary, emotional boundary, physical boundary, smaller, stuff like that. Yeah, they can say, she said, okay, I agree, perhaps, that defining Vilma at the edge of my skin doesn't seem to be working very well. How do I know that the thing you're proposing works better? Try it. You know, I always say that. You know, people do ask me that. I say just try it for a while. I mean, ultimately, you're not supposed to accept anything in Buddhism. The Buddha said don't accept it. I say try. Try it in a small sense. Try it with one other person for a while. I'd say that after, I always tell people, seriously, if you practice any particular Buddhist practice seriously and sincerely for 6 months, you should personally come to some conclusion about whether it's going to change things or not. And ultimately, no matter what I say, nothing matters except that. You know, no matter what I get up in here and say, it doesn't matter how logical it is, the proof is in the pudding. You know, you try it. And if it changes, then keep going. And if it doesn't change, then forget it. Seriously. But the caveat is that it must be a serious effort. And it must be an effort which is corresponds to what the teachings say. So most people either fail on one or the other. They don't put forth a serious effort and then they complain about the teachings. Or they adjust the teachings and then practice that and say, it doesn't work, you know. Practice the pure teachings in a serious way and confirm it. And if you can't confirm it, I would stop. I would do something else. Yeah. If it's true that you define things yourself, if it's true that nothing has any nature of its own, which it is true, then can't we just sit here and say, I'm in paradise already? And the answer is, and we've taught it many, many times, is karma. You know, your reality is flexible. Your reality is arbitrary, but it's forced upon you by your past deeds. Okay? Depending precisely on how good or bad you've been, sit there in the dentist chair all you want and meditate about emptiness all you want and think that it's a flower being rubbed against your jaw all you want. But you and I know it'll hurt, you know, because even though it's arbitrary, it's forced on you by your past karma. You have to choose a new world that you want, and then you have to do the karma to make it be your new arbitrary world. So it's not arbitrary in the sense of will, of present tense willpower, no. It's not like that. Yeah, yeah. It's arbitrary in the sense that you have the power to design your future and change it. But what's right immediately present, you're stuck with that. No, when I say karma, I mean the causes. Oh, does that make it real? No, it doesn't make it real, and I'll tell you why. As the guy drills my tooth, and I feel pain. Is that pain self-existent? That's my question. Of course it is, because it's present, and I cannot change it. It's being forced on me. It's not arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. I'm saying no Novocaine. I'm saying the guy ran out of Novocaine. No, I mean, at the moment that you're hurting, can you change it? No. Does that make it self-existent pain? No. Why? Because the doctor loves it. Okay? For him, it's producing this result, you know? And he can be like, huh? No, for any one person, it's fixed at that moment. Okay? Is the way karma works arbitrary or fixed? It's fixed in the sense of Lengyepa, right? Lengyepa, Lepelchewa, Machepa da Machepa, Lechepa da Chumisawa. Four principles of karma. And one is, if you do good deeds, you get a good result. If you do good deeds, you get a pleasant result. If you do things that hurt other people, you get a painful result. That's fixed. Is it self-existent? No.
If something is a kind of pain, then it's something to remove. What use is saying that it's fixed here? You can't continue your argument of asking why the pains of all are something you must stop. If you're going to stop it, then you must stop all of it. If not, then mind's like all other beings.
So the first line here says, if something is a kind of pain, then it's something to remove. Meaning, any pain, anywhere, is your responsibility to remove. Okay, in your new idea of yourself. By the way, this is a it's called a very delam. It's called a very easy path, simple path. Why? Because you're not working for others, really. You're just working for yourself. You have expanded yourself to other people. So when you try to help someone who's depressed, or when you try to help out someone who doesn't have any money, who's traveling somewhere, like to DC or something, then when you do that, you're just helping yourself. So it's not a hard thing. It's called delam. Delam means easy path, no problem. Okay? So he says, if something is a kind of pain, you have to work to remove it. By the way, especially with mental afflictions, if you put up with a mental affliction around you, in your environment, it doesn't matter whose head it's in. If you know that one of your friends is having a problem with jealousy, if you know that one of your friends is having a problem with anger, you must take an interest in it. You know, it doesn't mean judge them or intrude in their life. But if you know that they're having a mental affliction which is making them suffer, you better do something about it. Sooner or later it will come to you. You know, I'm just talking practically here, okay? Sooner or later, this will have effects on you also. You have to realize that it's all one big ecology. You can't ignore anyone else's pain. Sooner or later it will hurt you. You know, like the pain in the foot, sooner or later, if the hand ignores the thorn in the foot, sooner or later the poison of the thorn will reach the hand. And it's... Sorry? Oh, no. Buddhist ethics, Buddhist bodhisattva activity, as we said before, is totally dependent only on your motivation and on your attempt to help. It's not defined by the success of your help. Why? Because you can perfect the perfection of giving, and there may be homeless people all over the place. No problem there. Okay? The trick is not to get upset when they tell you go to hell. Okay? You know, don't have another mental affliction that now somebody else is going to have to help you about. Okay? Yeah. Yeah, she said this, you know, although it's mind-boggling, I can imagine, you know, I could call everybody in this room Michael Roach. I mean, if I really, really try hard, I can imagine it. You know, I mean, I may not be able to do anything about it, but I can imagine that every person in this room is Michael Roach, and that I would enjoy it if each of you had a happiness in your own heart as much as if it were in my heart. I can imagine that. And I can even, this last week, I even did like two or three very wimpy, puny things to prove that I could do it, you know. And then I went back to taking care of myself. But what she said is, I feel oftentimes I don't have the wisdom to know what will be helpful to other people. Oftentimes, you go to help someone, you know, you give them some vitamins, you know, and then 20 years later they find out that these vitamins cause cancer, you know. Or you know, you try to help someone, you have a sincerely try to help someone, and then it causes this, you know, like somebody wants to reconcile with their wife or something. So you set it up and you make sure that they can reconcile. They set up a meeting with each other, and they meet each other, and then a fight breaks out, and she shoots her or something. Okay? So, like, I don't have the wisdom to know how things are going to end up. It's not required in Buddhism. There's this big thing in Buddhist ethics about to the best of your knowledge. To the best of your knowledge. Okay? For example, there's a Bodhi. I'll give you the example. I'll quote you the scripture. It's a Jetsun Kapas, Shunglam, where he discusses the Bodhisattva vows. And he said, there's a Bodhisattva vow against teaching emptiness to a large group of people, a certain kind of emptiness. You know, I'm not allowed to get up here and teach to this group a certain kind of emptiness teaching because it might freak a certain number of people out. And if they freak out, I broke my vow. Now, Jetsun Kapa says, what if you thought the person could handle it, and you taught them that, and then they freaked out? Do you break your Bodhisattva vow? And he says, no. To the best of your knowledge, to the best of your ability, you know, you have to evaluate the situation and do what you think would be the best thing to do. But if it blows up or something, you don't break your vow. It's not, you did not, you know, we are very limited in our wisdom, but you have to do what, according to your own knowledge, is the best thing at any given time, or else you can't do anything, right? Who knows if the kid's life you save, that that's the kid who blows up New York 30 years later? We don't know enough to say that. Go ahead and save them, you know. I can understand sharing money with people who are obviously in material need. But if a person has an emotional problem, like jealousy or desire or anger, isn't that better left to people who are specialists than to a Dharma student? I say Dharma students are better specialists than those other ones, you know. I say infinitely better specialists, because you know the real cure. And how much can you do for them, you don't know. But it also depends, there's many factors. They have to be close to you, they have to trust you, they have to be your fellow, you know, they have to be someone who loves you, who has confidence in you, and then slowly, in a friendly way, you help them work it out. And I've had this relationship with many of my students. You know, for years, we've helped each other with our mental afflictions, and it's very, very sweet. There's nothing sweeter. You know, we show each other our confession books. I get to see many people's confession books. If I blotted out the names of the particular people involved, you know, who they got jealous of, who they were angry of, it's all the same. It's all exactly the same. It's amazing. It's exactly the same wording even, you know. And after a while, you can predict who's going to be jealous of who, you know. And you can watch it start, and it's very interesting. No, you have to help your fellow Dharma student. By the way, there's a vow in the higher teachings, which I can't tell you about, which is very similar to that. It's a responsibility to help your fellow Dharma students. Why? Those emotions will cause them physical suffering beyond anything you can imagine. You know the destructiveness of a few moments of anger. You know, you're not saving them from feeling bad for 5 minutes, you're saving them from destroying years of good karma. There's a big difference, you know. They call it pain and the causes of pain. You have to help other people with their pain, and you have to help other people with the causes of pain, certain causes of pain. They're definitely doing something which is going to make them suffer. For Shantideva, for Master Shantideva, that's the same thing as suffering. It's very interesting. If you see somebody doing something which is definitely going to cause them to suffer intensely, then what's the difference between helping them with that and putting a band-aid on a big cut that they have on their arm? It's the same thing. Then he says, what's the use of saying that it's fixed here? Which means, why do you insist that this boundary has to be that? He says it directly in the root verse. Okay. Then he says, you can't continue this argument of asking why the pains of everyone are something that you're responsible to stop. Quit fighting against it. Agree. Okay. He said, Master Shantideva is getting a little impatient with us. You know, he says, you know, okay, I heard all your arguments. They're all silly. Now, stop arguing. Zopa man means, te man means, give it up. You know, admit that you have to take care of other people's sufferings as if they were your own. Because they are you. Okay? It's a lot easier if you give up on the you first. Give up on the me first, and there won't be any problem to take care of other people. If you're going to stop it, then you must stop all of it. He says, if you're going to go after any kind of suffering, meaning the one that you have, then you've got to stop all of them. Why are you going halfway? Then he says, if not, if you decide that other people's pain is not your problem, then stop taking care of your own pain, because that would be the logical thing to do. He does a reverse on us. He's a great debater. I'll run it by you again. You must stop any pain which exists in any person in the world. If you decide not to stop any pain that exists in any person in the world, then stop stopping your own pain. The reverse is true too. If you're going to pick and choose, then pick and choose with yourself. Next time you get a thorn in your foot, leave it there. Okay? Because you're deciding, you're picking and choosing. So, okay, pick and choose to the ultimate. Stop taking care of yourself. Stop taking care of your own pain. If you're not going to take care of everybody's pain, then it's logical that you should stop taking care of your own pain. Okay? If you're going to take care of your own pain, you better stop everybody's pain. You know, one or the other. Okay? He runs it back on you like that. He's a great debater.
The power of habit. By accustoming yourself to the idea, you can learn to think of a few drops of semen and blood that belongs to another person as being yourself, even though there's no such thing at all. Why then do you say you cannot think of these bodies of other people as being yourself as well? There isn't any difficulty in deciding that the bodies of others are your own body too.
You're going to hear over and over again Master Shantideva saying, if you practice, you can do anything. You know, if you practice a certain way of thinking, you can develop that way of thinking. You can come to believe anything if you practice it long enough. If you keep trying over and over again, basically you can convince yourself of anything. And all of that what you believe now is a result of the same process. Don't kid yourself. It's just that you got used to thinking of things this way, and that's why you think of things this way. It's not because they're necessarily right or wrong, okay? So he says, if you get used to it, because you got used to it, there's this stuff. There's some blood and there's some semen from totally people who are not related to you at all, totally different people, and you've decided that the result of this stuff is going to be me. And it's just from habit. It's just that people kept telling you, oh, Michael, you raise your hand. They say, yes, Michael. You know, and they say, Michael, stop doing that. And you stop doing it, and they're happy. I must be Michael. You know, and it's just habit. It's just force of habit. What makes that blood and that semen any more you than anything else? You know, it's just some stuff. But you start thinking of it as you, huh? Sorry. Whatever. Okay. in Tibetan they say chak. Okay. And then he says, even though there's no such thing at all, meaning there is no Michael. Meaning what? Is there a Michael or not? There better be, because it's the one who's keeping you from getting on your bus, okay? I mean, there is, right? A conventional Michael. But is there any Michael that we can say would have been there if you didn't think of them as Michael? No. Okay? Is there from its own side, is that stuff from your parents any more Michael than Jane or Jack or Joe or anything else? No. It's you decided to call it that. And you decided to think of it that way. And you decided that when that hurts, you'll do something, and when somebody else hurts, you won't do anything. And it's all arbitrary. Okay? You got to get used to that. Yeah. So does that become mind-only? The classical meaning of the mind-only school is much, much different. What we call the mind-only school is much, much different. Do we believe in outside physical matter, independent of our projections? No. Within our projection, is there outside physical matter? Yes. If you want to call that mind-only, you can, but it's not what we call mind-only. Okay, and there's a fight about it, big fight. Higher school says there does exist outside physical objects, although projected. Okay. Why do you claim that you cannot think of the bodies of other people as being yourself as well? You can think of a couple of drops of stuff as being Jay Siller, just because you decided to. But why do you have a problem calling this person you, or this person you? So what's the difference? Okay, Master Shani. By the way, it's so profound that it's going to go over your head. It's so profound it sounds stupid. Okay, it's extremely profound. It's absolutely true. You don't have to limit yourself to what you always did before. And try it the other way. It's amazing. It's fantastic. You know what it feels like to be romantically in love with someone. It's a brief period where you stretch the envelope a little bit, and you're actually trying to make them as happy as you are yourself. Imagine if you did it with everybody, all the time. You know, just imagine it, and that's what it feels like. And it feels as good, just more of them, right? Okay. Last thing he says, there isn't any difficulty in deciding that the bodies of others are your own body too. Okay? What it means is, it won't seem hard to you to take care of others as soon as you understand, or as soon as you decide that they are yourself. Okay? We are reaching the edge of the second method of getting bodhicitta. Okay? We had one already. What was it? It wasn't exchanging. It was deciding that me and others are exactly the same. It was called Dakshin Nyamba. We have finished Dakshin Nyamba. Okay? We've been through Dakshin Nyamba. Dakshin Nyamba means I decide that I will be ultimately democratic. No matter where there's a suffering, I will stamp it out. I don't care who's got it. I'll treat all sufferings equally. If anybody, anywhere, has any suffering, it has the same priority as my suffering. Okay? And then, on the other hand, if I could trigger a happiness or a pleasure in any person's heart, in this whole room, they have equal priority to my happiness. I will do it. You know, I will make sure that other people get the happiness. If I know that I could create a happiness in another person's mind, I'll do it, because all happinesses are equal. It's like this Jeffersonian happiness thing, okay? All happinesses are equal. All sufferings are equal. I will smash any suffering I see, doesn't matter who's got it. If I could see that I could make someone else happy, even though it's not in my brain or in my body, I'll do it. And that's Dakshin Nyamba. Now we go to Dakshin Jewa, okay? Say Dakshin.
Dakshin.
Jewa.
Jewa.
Dakshin.
Dakshin.
Jewa.
Jewa.
This is, you've heard a lot, exchanging yourself and others. Okay, Dak means me, Shen means others, Jewa means to exchange. When you change money in Tibetan, you know, from rupees to dollars, dollars to rupees, that's called Jewa. Okay, so you can see the usage of the term in the language. It really does mean to exchange. Okay, Dakshin Jewa is another version. It's another method of getting bodhicitta, okay, of gaining ultimate compassion. And it involves learning to cherish other people as much as you cherish yourself. So there's a little bit different twist, right? The other one was this great equality of all happinesses and the great equality of all sufferings. And I will stamp out one wherever it exists, and I will achieve one wherever it exists. But here it's, I will move my self-concern to other people. Okay, the same concern that I have for myself, I will now shift it to other people. Instead of taking care of number one, I take care of everybody else. His Holiness often says it's the only democratic thing to do. After all, they outnumber you about 6 billion to 1. So if you're going to be a Democrat, you better take care of them first. Okay? That's one of those reasonings which is pure, beautiful, true, exactly the truth, and it goes way over your head because you don't want to do it. Okay? It's absolutely true. They outnumber you like a couple billion to one. You should be last. Okay? You should take care of them first. So this is shifting your focus about who do you cherish. Do you take care of yourself first, or you take care of others first? Okay? This is Dakshin Jewa. Okay. We're going to read two verses fast, and then I'll give you a commentary in the next. So we'll go through the next two verses, okay?
The sources of all happiness and pain. Come to understand that for myself it's wrong, but for all others an ocean of fine qualities. Discard completely your habit of caring for yourself and learn to take on every other being. How far can we go? When you think of your hands and such, you do consider them all a part of your body. So why then don't you consider every creature that has a body as being one of the parts of the body of all living kind?
In this and some of the following verses, you need a commentary because the verse itself is not clear. And it's purposely like that. Okay? It says, for yourself it's wrong, but for other people It's where all good things come from. It means cherishing. Okay? Cherishing. Self-cherishing is wrong. Cherishing every other being will bring you... He says ocean. In Tibet and in India, the ocean was believed to be the source of all precious jewels. Okay? Like it was believed that diamonds, rubies, sapphires, emeralds all came from the bottom of the sea. And that if you went to the beach in this mythical place called the ocean, which Tibetans never saw, if you stood at the beach, you might be able to get emeralds and rubies and stuff. They would probably just float out from below the ocean. So they say, if you can learn to take care of other people first. I always say a bodhisattva should be the last one on the bus. You know, take care of other people first, and you will get everything you ever dreamed of. You know, take care of yourself first, you'll just get a lot of pain. Okay? Try it. It's radical. It's very radical. I see Margie drive through traffic. It's like that, you know? And it drives me crazy, you know? We're trying to get to the Quaker house. She's letting every cab go in front of us, you know? And and somehow we always get there. And she seems quite happy, you know? I don't know. That's the idea. You know, let them all go first. I'll be last. You know, and it works, okay? Try it out. All right. 24, please.
On the definition of myself. Because you've gotten used to it, you're able to think it's mine of this body, which actually has no self. Why do you say then you could never learn to think of others as me if you got used to it? If you could then, you would never feel that it was strange or conceited when you worked for others. You don't expect congratulations from yourself whenever you eat your dinner for yourself.
I think this is kind of cool. He says, you know, you go to, Sykes, McDonald's, right? And you buy yourself some French fries and a Coke, you know. I mean, personally, it's like a vanilla milkshake when I don't have a cold. And you go and you pay your money and you put it on the thing and you're like slobbering, you know, salivating. And you get the ketchup and you put it on there and you're like staring at it. And it's not like you go, good job, Mike, you know, we're going to feed you. You're going to feed me, you know. It would be silly to say that. As you eat the French fries, to keep congratulating yourself, you know, boy, you did a great job buying me those French fries, you know. You really did a good thing. I really appreciate it, you know. And I'm very grateful to you for buying French fries for yourself. You know, I mean, you don't sit there and say that at McDonald's, right? Even we don't say that. So, like, even when we're weird, right? So you just don't do it, you know. You don't do things like that. He says, you will reach a point, you will get to a point where when you take care of somebody else, it'll just feel natural to you. You will not feel like something amazing. You know, you won't pat yourself on the back when you help somebody else. Because by that time, you perceive it as feeding yourself. The trick is to get into the emotion of them being you. And then when you take care of them, it doesn't seem something incredible or fantastic. It's just simply taking care of yourself. So he says, you won't get a big head when you get to be a high-level bodhisattva. Because you will really perceive it just as like you're feeding your mouth. You don't congratulate your hand for bringing the French fries to your mouth. You know, and so you won't expect any thanks. Marvin and I were talking about it, right? Here it came, okay? You're not like you're waiting for yourself to congratulate yourself for lifting the French fries to your own face, okay? You won't feel like that. It also prevents conceit, okay? He says you won't feel like, oh, I'm so great, I'm helping everybody. I mean, a bodhisattva doesn't think that because he just sees it as feeding himself. Okay, like that. I'm going to put the Tibetan for that since it's on your homework. Say, Rangi.
Rangi.
Say.
Suna,
Lenla,
Rewa,
Migyup. Okay, Rangi means your own. Se means food. Suna means if you eat it. Meaning if you feed your own face, your own food.
Rangi se suna.
Len in this case, and in those of you who are going to be translators, it's unusual usage of the word len. It means something back. Normally, len means an answer, but here it means like gratitude or something in return. Okay, len means in this case an answer in the sense of something in return.
Len la, towards that, Rewa migyat.
Rewa means hope. Migyat means you don't do it. Meaning, you don't sit there and wait for yourself to congratulate yourself when you feed your own face. Okay? You don't sit there and expect some kind of gratitude or something back from yourself when you feed yourself. You don't expect yourself to say, thank you, Mike, you know, that was really good French fries. I appreciate that you bought them for me. Okay? And just like that, bodhisattvas, they don't have this emotion of like expecting someone to say, oh, you're so wonderful, thank you for helping me. Because for them it just seems like feeding their own mouth. Okay?
Rangi means your own. Se su means to eat
your food.
Na means if or when. Len la means something in return. Rewa means to hope.
Migyat means you don't do it. Meaning you don't have any hopes for something in return when you feed yourself. It's not like you're waiting for yourself to congratulate yourself. Okay? Mr. Hector. Number 25.
The enemy of the body. Because of your attachment for your body, you feel great feelings of fear for little frightening things. This same body, though, is a source of terror. Who then wouldn't despise it like they would some hated enemy?
Read 26 as well.
On the evil we do for the body. We spend our days to find a technique of curing those illnesses of the body, hunger and thirst and the rest. To do so, we slaughter birds and fish and wild beasts of the forest too. We lay in wait at crossroads for it, for profit, and to win the honor of others' givers. We would even kill our parents, stealing also things belonging to the triple jewels, passing on to burn for it in hell of endless torment. What wise man could ever then desire this body, care for it, and make unto it offerings? Who is it that wouldn't see the body as the enemy? Who then not disdain it?
Basically what Master Shantideva is saying, you know, the objection that comes up into your mind when I say, if you're a bodhisattva, a prospective bodhisattva, you should get on the bus last. Then you think, well, on certain nights I wouldn't get on the bus. I mean, it would be like 10 o'clock before I got on the bus. If I didn't push in front, or if I didn't make sure I got on the bus, I would be the last one on the bus. Or I might not get on the bus. And then I'd have to wait another half hour. And I'd miss class about how to be a bodhisattva, you know, anyway. What would be harmed in that case? It's your body. Okay? Like your body might get a little hungry, or your body might get a little thirsty, or your body wouldn't get to howl New Jersey in front of the other bodies. And Master Shantideva says, you're working for the enemy. What is that? Sleeping with the enemy, right? You're in bed with the enemy. You know, the enemy is your body. Okay? Your body is the enemy. By trying to push, you're doing all this who? For whom? For your body. Your body should get to New Jersey first. You know, your body should eat. So if it's really hungry, and if circumstances demand it, your body, you should kill animals to feed your body. Okay? If things got to that, I should kill animals to feed my body. And in order to get the fame I want, or the things I want, I should even hurt my parents. Or even I should steal things from the Dharma, from a Dharma center, or something like that. If I want something bad enough, I should do it. For what? For your body. Okay? For your body. And then he says, think about your body. You know, you go walking down the street. This happened to me in Arizona, even my last retreat. It happens like every retreat. And there's this huge snake there, you know. And I'm like, ah, you know. And it's me and the snake, you know. And he kept coming out when I was meditating. And I couldn't catch him, you know. And I didn't want to catch him, actually. And So I was like scared of him, and he's probably really scared of me. But anyway, who are you scared of? Who are you scared for? You're scared for your body. You're afraid the snake's going to hurt your body. But Master Shantideva says, if you think about it, your body is much more frightening than the snake. You know, your body is much more scary than the snake. Your body's going to kill you. You know, your body's going to get cancer. Your body's going to get AIDS. Your body's going to get arthritis.
Your body's going to get uglier and uglier, shorter and shorter, more and more pain. And really, the most scary thing in your life is your body, not the snake that's going to hurt your body. You know, you're walking around in the most scary thing in the world. And you're doing all these bad things to take care of that thing, you know. Let it go. You know, he says, stop taking, it's this, he's talking about self-cherishing, you know. Don't do bad deeds for this body. It ain't worth it. You got to leave it anyway. You know, it's going to get old. It's going to hurt you much worse than not getting the first bus to New Jersey. You know, the body that you push to get on the bus so it can have dinner on time is going to make you suffer. Why respect it so much? You know, why do you kiss its ass? You know, he says, spit on it. He says that. He says, wise men should disdain it, he says. I mean, nice English, okay? But he says wise men should just look upon it as the enemy. Okay, you got to put up with it. Take minimum care of it. But don't become a slave of it. You know, don't suck up to it. Don't suck up to its demands that you do things to hurt other people so that you can live longer in this thing that's going to kill you anyway. You know, he says, don't fool yourself. He says, stop cherishing yourself. Because ultimately what we're often cherishing is our bodies. You know, the reason you can't do exchanging self and others is very mainly that you want to take care of this body, which is even more frightening than all the things that you're worried about that are going to happen to it. Okay, so identify the enemy. The enemy is your own body. Don't hurt other people to help this thing that's your real enemy. Okay? And that's part of Dakshin Jewa. And then he gives a whole list of bad deeds that you do to keep your body going. Interestingly, he talks about killing animals for food. Okay?
If I use it myself, what will I have to give others? Thinking of yourself and saying, if I give, what will I have for me, is nothing but demonic. To think of others and to say, if I use it for myself, what will I have to give, is angel dharma.
This is really cool. I mean, the Tibetan is very, very powerful, and it's very hard to put into English, especially if you're restricted to so many beats or something. But the point is, it's very common. I mean, I think it occurred in almost everyone's mind here when we started talking about expanding yourself to others. Your income just dropped by half. You know what I mean? Like each person, it happens to me actually. Each person you envelop in your world, you know, it's like your income drops by another certain percentage. You know, if you got 12 people, it's like your income just dropped to 8% of what it used to be. And you start to think, I believe it occurred to many people in this room, and it occurs to me, mentally you put a limit on it. You say, I could maybe take one homeless person or maybe two, but you get up to three or four and I wouldn't even be able to go out for Starbucks or anything, you know? I mean, there's a limit in your mind to what you would do. There's a percentage that beyond that I can't do it, you know. And Master Shantideva says, it's sick to think, if I give all this stuff away, what will I have to use for myself? You know, he says, that is Degitsu. Degitsu, De means the devil, demons. Devils, demons. He says, that thought is the devil. You know, that thought is a demon. To think to yourself, if I give away all this pizza, you know, if there's eight people there and I'm number nine and I give away all eight slices, duh, you know, there's nothing left for me, you know. What, I gotta save at least one. He says that thinking, that way of thinking is demonic. That's a Hitler mind state, literally. I mean, the word in Tibetan is like Hitler, you know, it's like very, very strong. It's like this is the evilest thing you could have. And then he says, bodhisattvas, people in this room, as you get better at it, when you take your first bite of pizza, you should be looking around and saying, wait a minute, if I eat this, what are these other people going to have? You know, and then you have to pause. You know, anytime you use something for yourself, you have to say, wait. If I eat this, if I spend this money, well, what are they going to have to use? And you actually stop. And you make sure everybody else has enough first. And that's Dakshin Nyamje, that's Dakshin Jewa. Okay? That's where they get first priority. Because they outnumber you. Okay? Democracy, right? I've noticed that democracy is the right way until we're the minority. Right? So they go first. They come first. Before you use something, make sure nobody else needs it. Okay? You should not be worried, what am I going to... It's like, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can... Right? Same thing. You know, you shouldn't be going, gee, if I give this away, will I have to eat myself? You have to be thinking, if I eat this thing, what am I going to give to those Sykes if he shows up? Maybe I should wait, you know? Like that, okay? And that's a bodhisattva state of mind. Yeah. Yeah, she says, if I give my car away, what would I have to get to work, for example? By the way, bodhisattva ethics is the following. And there's two principles working here. A, you cannot give more than is comfortable for you. You know, you are not allowed, you are prohibited by the Buddha from giving away something that you would regret later because it's a very bad deed to regret it. You see what I mean? You are prohibited from giving that away. You cannot give away more than your level at that time. And you must constantly strive to raise that level. You know, it's, you have a dual duty. You have to keep fighting to raise that level of how much you can give away. But at the same time, you are prohibited by the Buddha from giving away more than you can handle. You know, spend a certain amount of your income on flowers. But if it comes the day that you would complain about it, or worry about it, or feel uncomfortable about it, or regret that you did it, you must stop. You know, you have to back up. And you're prohibited from going beyond that, you know. At the same time, if you're a good bodhisattva, baby bodhisattva, you should be thinking, yeah, but next week I'm going to go further. You know, I'll be able to do more next week, and I will. But right now I understand my limitations. That's the first answer. Secondly, it's the responsibility of a bodhisattva to evaluate what would be the most use for everybody. You know, I could give away all my clothes. You know, and I could go to work in my birthday suit. And then I'd get thrown out. And I wouldn't be able to support these classes, for example, or something like that. Or if I'm spending money like that, that would be foolish. So, I mean, a bodhisattva has to be practical. And I think if you look at Ken Rinpoche, this is the great value of having a root lama, of being around a root lama. You observe how they act. You know, they tell you more by their actions than by their teachings. And he's very practical. You know, he's very practical. He does not spend money on himself. He doesn't spend a penny on himself. But he collects money very carefully. He stores it. He invests it. He takes care of it. And when the moment's ready, he gives it all away in an instant. You know, I've seen him give away 10, 20 years of money and go back down to zero. Doesn't worry about it at all. But he doesn't waste his money. And he doesn't blow his money. And he doesn't give it to every person he meets on the street. You know, he carefully plans his virtues, and then he executes his virtues. And that's the deal. You know, you have to be practical in that sense. Watch those high lamas. And they're being very practical. And then they do great things. And they help many more people. Okay. And then he says the opposite. You know, if I use it for myself, what will I give to others? Is angel dharma. I like the word angel. I know not everybody likes it. But the point is, in Tibetan, there's two words. Say de, hla. De, hla. Sometimes hla means an enlightened deity. Sometimes hla means a worldly pleasure being or something. This is a different use of the word. It's as opposed to de. Okay? Hla cha means the Buddha Dharma. Hla dharma means Buddha Dharma. Okay? And de means the devil, the demons, the Hitlers in the world, you know. And that's the opposition. So I called it angel dharma. Angel dharma and the work of demons. What's the work of demons? If I give this away, what am I going to have to use myself? What's the work of angels? You know, what's Buddha dharma? If I eat this, what am I going to have if David Sykes walks in? You know, I better keep it in the refrigerator until it gets green or something, you know. All right? Okay. The next two verses are the holiest verses in the Shantideva's work. Okay? They're the holiest verses in the Bodhisattva Charyavatara. And you have to memorize them, okay? And they come in very holy prayers many, many times. And you have to memorize them, okay? So...
No many words are needed. The total amount of happiness that exists in the world has come from wanting to make others happy. The total amount of suffering that exists in the world has come from wanting to make yourself happy. What need is there for any words? The children of the world work for their own sake. The able Buddhas do their labor for the sake of others. Come and see the difference.
Say, Jikten, Dewa, Chinyepa, Dekun, Shende, Dulechu. Okay. Jikten means in the whole world. Dewa means happiness. Chinyepa means whatever there is. Dekun means all of it. Shen means other people. De means happiness. De means wanting. Lechu means it comes from. And it means, to translate it, all the happiness that exists in the world comes from wanting to bring happiness to other people. And it's true, and then, you know, if you want to be happy, that's the whole bottom line. And in the next verse he says, I don't have to say anything else. That's all you need to know. And you just have to do it. So there's no need to, there's no commentary. Just do it. You'll never be happy if you don't do it. Say, Jikten, Dunya, Chinyepa, Dekun, Rande, Dule, Chum. Jikten means in the whole world. Dunya means pain. Chinyepa means whatever amount there is, whatever pain there is in the whole world. Dekun means all of it. Rande means your own happiness. Du means wanting. Du means wanting. Le Chu means it comes from. Translation here is that every pain that exists in the entire world comes from the desire to find happiness only for yourself. It's funny, Shantideva in the next line, he just says that that's all I need to say, I'm not going to say anything else. There's nothing more to say. Okay, he says that's all. And you know, your mind says, oh, there must be some kinds of pains like earthquake that doesn't come from people being selfish. But it does. And your mind says, oh, there must be some kinds of happiness like birds singing in the trees or the ocean being beautiful that doesn't come from serving other people, but it's a lie. Every beautiful thing in the world exists because somebody served some other person. You can't experience a thing of beauty. No beauty can be experienced in the world. No happiness can be experienced in the world. No pleasure could exist in the world unless, as a cause of that, someone has served someone else. Someone has done something to make someone else happy. There isn't any good object which exists in this world which is not a product of somebody taking care of somebody else. Karmically speaking, it doesn't exist. There's no such thing. And there doesn't exist any suffering in this world, anything that wasn't caused by someone being selfish. Period. Doesn't exist. You know. And he just says, think about it. You don't need to know anything else. He says, that's all you need to know. You know, just do it. Okay. I'll put the English up here. In a practical sense, if you've been through these last two classes, then you have two things to do. Dakshen Nyamba, Dakshen Jewa. Say Dakshen Nyamba, Dakshen Jewa. Dakshen Nyamba, Dakshen Jewa. Dakshen Nyamba means treat yourself and others exactly the same. You know, if someone has some pain, go after it the same way you would go after your own pain. If you see that you could make someone happy, go do it as much as you would try to make your own self happy. Be democratic in that sense. You're exactly the same as other people. That's the first thing. The second one is more radical. Dakshen Jewa is more radical. Now it's saying there's a certain amount of happiness in the world to be created. There's a certain amount of suffering in the world to be stamped out. Go for theirs first. Okay? Go after theirs first. It's very radical. Okay? If you can find any kind of happiness that you can create in another person, that takes priority. Go after that first. if there's any kind of suffering that has to be stopped and it's in someone else, go after theirs first. Take care of them first. Okay, it's very radical. And then he wraps it up by saying, I don't need to tell you anything else. If you want to reach joy, real joy, if you want to be truly happy, that's why you came to this class. I mean, ultimately, the reason you came here is that you want to be happy. That's all you need to know. Take care of other people first. And watch and observe. And by the way, it's not these monumental things. It's little things, you know. Buddhist ethics, Buddhist morality, bodhisattva behavior. It starts with little things. It's all little things, you know. It's being in a restaurant, taking care of the other person's order first, you know. It's walking through a door, making sure they go first. It's sitting with someone who's a little sad, and you're feeling lousy too, and you take care of their sadness first. It's all little things, real bodhisattva behavior. If you track it with your book, you start to notice that the reality is it's all little things. If you're behaving pure with the little things, the big things will take care of themselves. It's not like you're going to have to go out and cut your arm off. It's not like that. Your opportunities and all sentient beings are the people in your family. They're your friends. They're the people around you. And that's all sentient beings for you, and you have to take care of them first. And it's the hardest ones. It's much easier to take care of all sentient beings than to take care of Aunt Joan that you don't like. You know what I mean? It's much easier to work for all sentient beings than to take care of the person next door. But it starts with them. You have to do it that way. So if you see an opportunity for a happiness to be created, don't be non-democratic, you know. Go for the one that's going to make somebody else happy. Go for it. You know, don't say it has to be in my mental continuum. It has to be in my bank account. It has to be in my garage. You know, if you see a happiness that could be created, go and create it. And I think treat yourself like an artist or a sculptor. You know, if you're an artist, you make paintings. If you're a sculptor, you make sculptures. If you're a carpenter, you make beautiful tables or something. But if you're a bodhisattva, you make happiness in other people. And that's what you do for a living. That's your product. It's very cool. It's very cool. Like, think of yourself as an artisan. You know, think of yourself as a craftsman. And what you produce is happiness in other people's hearts. And that's your job. And that's what you do. People say, what does your factory make? You know, what's your product? What product does your bodhisattva factory make? Oh, we make happiness. Where? In other people's hearts, you know. How good are you at it? Oh, you should see the one I did last week, man. It was a work of art, you know. I think there should be a bodhisattva museum in New York City. And there should be these great happinesses that people were able to give to other people. Or we were thinking that there should be one next to it called the Mental Affliction Museum. And there would be great instances of people in our classes who overcame a certain mental affliction. Like, there's people, I know people in this class who used to be really jealous in 1996, and they worked on it, and it's not there anymore. And that's a work of art. That should be put in a museum somewhere. The dead body of that jealousy, you know, should be hung up somewhere, and they should write a testimonial how they did it. And that's something to admire. That's handiwork, you know, that's artisan. That's a work of art. You know, people should collect them and talk about them and write catalogs of them. You know, in 1995, such and such a Dharma person at Asian Classics Institute got rid of their jealousy or struck a good blow to their jealousy, you know, and then they would tell how they did it, and there'd be a video and everything, and it would be, you know, and there would be on the news, there would be an announcement, you know, like, you know, Michael Roach overcame this jealousy last week. It's really cool how he did it, you know, and the way he did it, and all the battle that went on, you know, and how many blows he took from the enemy before he beat the enemy, and how sore he was afterwards, you know. And like that. It should be like that. So that's your first go after any kind of happiness or suffering there is in the world, and then make it other people first. And you'll be happy. And that's why you came here. You came here to be happy. That you don't have to say anything else. That's how to get happy. Just try it. Try it on a very wimpy, microcosmic level with someone close to you this week. and you'll start to get a taste for it. And then you'll get you get to be a connoisseur of it, and you'll want to eat it all the time. Okay? All right, we'll pray.
Dambagunye Dombasho.